Corbin Middlemass here. The Ashes were awesome, but they are over. The good news is the cricket keeps rolling as the focus shifts to the T20 World Cup. Australia is trying to climb back to the top, India is looking all powerful, and England is trying to turn Ashes shame into T20 glory. And did we mention the backroom power struggles? The ABC Cricket Podcast is dropping every Monday and Friday as former opener Ed Cowan joins me to pull apart the juiciest storylines in the game. Search for ABC Cricket Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
August 2020. Alexei Navalny is at an airport in the Russian town of Tomsk. He's there with a couple of assistants, laughing and joking with the other passengers. They're waiting for a morning flight to Moscow, over 3,000 kilometers away. People ask for photos. He obliges. As a vocal opposition leader, he's well known in Russia. Passengers heading to Moscow board a shuttle bus that takes them to a small plane. They find their seats and the plane takes off. But a few minutes after they're airborne, Navalny starts to feel funny. A little sweaty. A little sick. Maybe it's because he hasn't eaten any breakfast. All he's had is a cup of tea. He gets up to go to the bathroom. He's been there a while, 20 minutes at least. Someone knocks. No answer. People are queuing outside the door. By now, the four flight attendants realize something's wrong. They make an urgent announcement. Is there a doctor on board? No one puts up their hand. They move Navalny to a private part of the plane and lay him on the floor. Attendants give him first aid. Meanwhile, one of his assistants walks the aisles, desperately looking for anyone who can help. She finds a nurse. By this stage, they've been in the air for about 2 hours, and Navalny is getting worse. He's moaning and screaming incoherently. No words, just sounds. People try to get him to drink water, but he retches. They tell him, drink, breathe. The plane's forced to make an emergency landing in Omsk, a large city in Siberia. Medics rush Navalny to a local hospital. They ask one of his assistants what's happened. She says, I don't know. He was probably poisoned. Days later, Navalny's family has him transferred to a hospital in Berlin. He's alive, but barely. Doctors put him in an induced coma. He stays that way for 2 weeks. Navalny's assistant was right. He had been poisoned. German doctors tell him the toxin was from the family of nerve agents called Novichok, a finding confirmed by labs in France and Sweden. It's a Soviet-era chemical weapon favored by Russia's spy agency, the FSB. And before them, the notorious KGB. Alexei Navalny survives. The attempt to kill him has failed. But if there's one thing Russian secret agents know, it's how to play the long game. Hello, my friend. I'm Aslan Pahari. And this is Assassins, the show where we unravel history's most shocking assassinations. Alexei Navalny was essentially a one-man opposition to Russian President Vladimir Putin. An anti-corruption campaigner, he led rallies against Putin. He even campaigned to take Putin's job, a risky proposition at the best of times. Before he was president, Putin ran the Russian Secret Service, the FSB, and then became head of the authoritarian state. He's an intimidating man, and Navalny knew the risks. So why did he stick his neck out to stand up to Putin? And maybe more interestingly, why did a regime famous for throwing critics out of windows allow someone as loud as Navalny to live for so long? After the episode on the plane, Alexei Navalny spends months recovering in Berlin. But he's not sitting idle. because there are questions that need answering. Most importantly, who poisoned him and could he prove it? Working with the investigative organization Bellingcat, Navalny tracks down his poisoners via phone records, flight logs, and other data. Then, Navalny impersonates an FSB official and calls one of the operatives on the phone. He pretends he's trying to find out what went wrong with the assassination attempt. Within 45 minutes, the operative starts spilling all the details. That he was involved in the operation against Navalny, that the target would be dead if it weren't for the quick action by the flight crew, and that he later tampered with Navalny's clothes to remove traces of Novichok. Even while fighting off a deadly poison, Navalny is still tracking down his would-be killers and putting the evidence on YouTube. How embarrassing for the Kremlin! The first rule of spycraft is don't get caught. But it's hardly the first time Navalny has pulled off something so audacious. And it's key to his success as an activist. Navalny's childhood is eventful. His mother is a Russian economist, and his dad's a Ukrainian Soviet army officer. He grows up in garrison towns in Moscow, but spends summers with his grandmother in Chernobyl. Yeah, that Chernobyl. After the meltdown of the Chernobyl nuclear reactor in 1986, Navalny's relatives are evacuated. But the Soviet cover-up of the catastrophe marks him deeply. Years later, he'd talk about how the local residents were forced to plant potatoes in irradiated soil, digging in all that toxic dust. He takes the offense to heart. He studies finance and law. He learns the ins and outs of corporate power. And then he shifts its focus to politics. After a few years working with an opposition party, he strikes out on his own to focus on his real gripe, corruption. Navalny becomes an activist shareholder in big Russian oil and gas companies. He buys minority stakes, attends shareholder meetings, and exposes shady contracts at the highest levels. Imagine how popular that made him with the oligarchs. He posts all his findings on his blog. Remember blogs? And it gets big. Real big. Off the back of his popularity, Navalny creates a whole new organization, the Anti-Corruption Foundation. He brands Russia's ruling party the Party of Crooks and Thieves. That slogan is widely used in the 2011 elections, in which the government's vote collapses. But it's Russia, so they still win. The European Court of Human Rights says the election was compromised and unfair. Thousands take to the streets in protest, and it cements Navalny as one of the most influential politicians in the country. He wants Putin out, but now he also wants his job. He runs for mayor in 2013 and wins just over a quarter of the vote, an astonishing figure in a state that represses dissent. But he doesn't win. A few years later, he campaigns for president. Maybe he's the man to topple Putin. But the next year, he's charged with embezzlement and fraud. The authorities try to put him in jail, and thousands rally in his support. Then, they decide to release him. Navalny and those in his circle assume he's being allowed to live only because to kill him would make him a martyr. But that doesn't mean the authorities do nothing. He now faces a decade-long pattern of being charged and released, or given suspended sentences, or jailed for short periods, or put under house arrest. The state says he is a criminal and an extremist. Navalny says Putin is simply testing the waters, seeing how the world reacts to the targeting of a dissident. Over the years, Navalny only becomes more prominent, and the threats become more physical. while serving a 30-day jail term for calling protests in which over 1,000 people are arrested, Navalny becomes gravely ill. His eyes and face swell up, rashes appear all over his body. He suspects he's been poisoned. The authorities take him to hospital for what they say is a severe allergic reaction and discharge him quickly. His personal doctor says it's suspicious and that his symptoms were definitely caused by some kind of toxic chemical agent. This poisoning occurs almost exactly a year before he's poisoned again on that plane to Moscow. Navalny's recovery from that Novichok poisoning was rough. He spent time on a ventilator, suffered neurological symptoms, and had a host of other issues, many long-term. But 5 months later, after exposing the operatives who tried to kill him, he decides to go back to Russia. Why would he do that? Russian authorities have already threatened to arrest him if he returns. But he also knows there's a hero's welcome in store if he does. January 17th, 2021. Navalny is on a plane again. Hundreds of his supporters gather at the airport waiting for him to land. In fact, they're defying a ban to be there. But at the last moment, his flight is diverted to a different airport, one with no media or supporters waiting. And there, he's promptly arrested for failing to appear for a parole hearing because he was recovering from the Novichok in Germany. No fanfare, no soapbox. Navalny is sentenced to 2.5 years in a penal colony on what he says are fabricated charges. Mass protests erupt across the country and continue for weeks. It's the largest anti-government demonstration since the ones Navalny himself led back in the 2011 elections. Tens of thousands show up, chanting for his release, shouting anti-Putin slogans. Police crack down, arresting and jailing hundreds of protesters. Navalny's associates are arrested. If the government thought arresting his friends would suppress the movement, they were wrong. Navalny continues directing protests from his cell. The Kremlin bans his anti-corruption foundation, accusing it of fanning hatred against authorities. And then they start turning the screws in earnest. Navalny is charged and sentenced again and again. And each time he appears in court, he looks more and more emaciated. He's sentenced to 9 more years for embezzlement. But even as he wastes away, he laughs and cracks jokes. Though he refuses to renounce anything he's said or done. Then, they sentence him to another 19 years for extremism. And this time, he's sent to one of Russia's worst penal colonies, a place called IK3, or the polar wolf in Siberia, in the Arctic Circle. Polar wolf is where the Russian government sends its most dangerous prisoners, its most troublesome dissidents, and anyone else it would rather see dead. In a prison like this, where temperatures reach minus 20 degrees Celsius, the weather itself is the punishment. He talks about the horrific conditions, the long periods of solitary confinement, chronic sleep deprivation, forced proximity to disease and other illnesses, but somehow, Navalny endures it all with good humour. From his prison camp, he jokes that since he's in the Arctic Circle now, he's the new Santa Claus. Even during his final court appearance, he jokes sarcastically with the judge, saying he has tears flowing down his cheeks from seeing him again. And yet, just one day later, on the 16th of February 2024, the Russian authorities make an announcement. Alexei Navalny has died. They claim he collapsed while out on a walk in the frigid conditions. The Kremlin's version of events is that he died of natural causes, brought on by chronic heart arrhythmia. Whatever killed Alexei Navalny, the message to the Russian people is clear. Stay out of trouble. Not even global prominence will protect you. But Navalny knew the risks and left his fellow Russians a message. Listen, I've got something very obvious to tell you. You are not allowed to give up. If they decide to kill me, it means we are incredibly strong. So don't be inactive. Tragically, Navalny's story almost turned out differently. A few days after he dies, international headlines read, Navalny was about to be freed. The White House was in its final stages of negotiating his release with Russia as part of a prisoner swap. Alexei Navalny was this close to freedom. Navalny's widow, by the way, is now on the warpath. Yulia Navalnaya released supposedly leaked photos of her husband's prison cell from that day, where you can see fresh vomit. She says other documents smuggled out of Polar Wolf show that just before his death, Navalny complained of severe stomach pain and that he fell unconscious in his cell. She even claims she obtained biological samples of him, which were then sent to independent labs outside of Russia. She says those results confirmed what she already knew, that he died by poison. Problem is, she hasn't offered any details. Instead, she's urged the labs themselves to publicly release their findings. But they haven't. Kinda weird, right? Whatever really happened, this story's not over yet. Assassins is hosted by me, Aslan Pahari. Hannah Jose is the producer. Sound by Tegan Nichols. Kyla Slaven is the supervising producer. Executive producers are Joel Werner, Eric George, and Jessica Radburn. As well as listening to Assassins, you can watch full episodes of the show on YouTube and Spotify. Those videos are shot and edited by Tejas Bhatt. If there's an assassination you think we should cover on the show, please email us, assassins@abc.net.au. I hope to hear from you soon, my friend.